Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Thanks to Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present tonight. And we would also like to thank our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and the Seattle Times for their generous support of library programs. And we're also grateful to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Private gifts to the foundation from thousands of donors help the library provide free programs and services that touch lives to everyone in our community. So to Library Foundation donors here with us tonight, we say thanks very much for your support. Now let me turn the podium over to Karen Maeda Allman from Elliott Bay Book Company, who will introduce the rest of the program.
Good evening, and thank you for coming to the program today. Tonight we're hosting Tim Wu. He's a policy advocate and journalist, formerly for Slate, where he was awarded a Lowell Thomas Medal for Travel Journalism, and also at the New Republic and other places. He is now a contributing writer to TheNewYorker.com, where he's written about all kinds of topics, including the Google Books Project, the economics of real estate speculation, Amtrak, and other topics. He's a professor at Columbia Law School and director of the Polyak Center for the Study of First Amendment Issues at Columbia Journalism School. He's probably best known for his writing on intellectual property, internet governance, and for popularizing the term net neutrality, and his role in arguing for the importance of open access. His first book, Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of the Information Empires, was named among the best books of 2010 by many outlets, including The New Yorker and Fortune. And he speaks tonight about his most recent book, The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside of Our Heads. And this is both a cultural history and I'd say it's also a call to action. And by first attending to the history of advertising and the ways that it operated and strategies for in various kinds of media, including print media, radio, and also digital, certainly, he helps us better understand the ways in which our own attention is bought and sold, and this process also resisted. It's certain to be much studied in the aftermath of the recent election, especially, and in many ways this story continues to be written, and I'm sure he'll be addressing some more recent developments, or you can ask about this. So please join me in welcoming Tim Wu.
Well, let me just briefly say thank you for all coming. I think they're recording it for the podcast, so I better say a little bit, which is just I'm incredibly grateful to be here. And this is such a beautiful library that's an honor to speak here. So let me, in the next 20 minutes or so, tell you a little bit about this book and give you a sense of the historic arc that it covers. I mean, it's impossible to describe fully 200 years of history in 20 minutes, but I'll do my best. So this book is centered on a particular kind of business, once obscure, that has spread to almost every facet of our lives, and in fact, does more perhaps than almost any other business to affect your day-to-day existence. The business model, the attention merchant business model, works like this. As opposed to a normal kind of business, which sells a product, you know, shoes or donuts, the attention merchant sells people to advertisers. The business model depends on gathering a crowd, either by giving something away for free or finding some place where people are a captive audience, and then taking that audience and reselling it to advertisers. It's kind of an unusual business model. It's counterintuitive. It certainly didn't exist for most of human history. And part of why I wrote this book was to sort of understand where this business model came from, where in particular advertising was invented. I was thinking, you know, where did advertising come from? And to explain how it came to play such an important role in our lives. The broad arc of the story is the business model began in tabloid journalism in the 1830s in New York City, and has now come to encompass the television media, radio media, but of course Facebook, Google, Twitter, and many other parts of our day-to-day existence. So let me start at the source of the Nile, rewinding the clock back to 1833, where we find ourselves with a man named Benjamin Day, who was history's first intention merchant and an inventor not well known to the public, who has really done quite a bit to affect how we live. Benjamin Day had a printing house, and he was a businessman. He wore a big top hat and serious about business. And he had this idea of running a newspaper in a profoundly different way than had ever been attempted before. So if you rewind 1833, newspapers were expensive. They were 6 cents, expensive back then. They were boring, I mean really boring. If you take a look at them, you can hardly get through them. Is this more people coming in? And they reprinted economic news, financial statements. They often had entire speeches by politicians just printed in the newspaper. They were usually run by one-person operations. They didn't have large audiences. This was newspapers at the time. The largest had a circulation of 2,000 in a city of 300,000. So Day had this different idea, and it had three essential components. The first is that he lowered the price to a single penny. At that price, he would be operating at a loss unless he figured out some other way to make money. Step number two is he made the newspaper much more interesting. He reported on crime, on mayhem, on murder stories, gossip. It didn't matter. Anything that was interesting, he put in the newspaper. So we had the beginning of what you might call interesting journalism or human interest journalism. And as a third addition, in order to increase the sales, he hired young boys to go in the street and hawk the paper, announce the headlines. Maybe you've seen this in old movies. You know, get your paper right here. So his business model, and I'll tell you a little bit about the stories he got. I think it's, you know, we think, oh, it's not going to be interesting. Oh, no. The first headline of the first issue of this newspaper was "A Melancholy Suicide." Sort of interesting. You might want to see, well, okay, what was going on? Oh, it was a fascinating story. This man who lived in New York was in love with a woman. His father didn't think they were a suitable couple and was going to send the man to Indonesia. Instead of going, he took his own life. Sad story. There were stories of slaves whose marriages were split by being sold. There were stories, this is another story in one of the early newspapers. A sailor was found with a problem in his stomach. They looked inside and appeared to be moving around. They tried every medicine possible. Nothing was working. So someone came up with the idea of putting a dish of warm milk in front of his mouth, and out leaped a 5-foot serpent. This was in the newspaper. And the sailor's life was saved. So as you can tell, some of the things that we call journalistic ethics and veracity of stories weren't necessarily established yet. Nonetheless, there was a critical moment, a couple months into it, where the lift of revenue from advertising, so I should say he started to gather very large audiences. These were just so much more interesting than your average newspaper. The lift of advertising revenue exceeded the weight of printing costs, and at some magic moment in 1833, this business model took flight, and I would suggest our world has never been the same since. Because, as I've suggested, when you have a model that can, business that can operate only on the basis of advertising, You can offer the kind of products we see today, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Twitter, Google, free TV, free radio, you name it. All of this was born in that moment. Well, that is a first moment. I'll add a little an addendum to the end of the story. One challenge for Mr. Day is that as soon as he started making money, and he started making a lot of money, he started facing competitors. And in fact, he faced a competitor who was even more outrageous than he was, a Scotsman by the name of Jonathan Gordon Bennett, who was a former school teacher, severely cross-eyed, strange man, wrote very long sentences, and made his, you can see them in the book, made his newspaper popular by two things. Number one, he, even more than the New York Sun, focused on the issue of death and killings. I think there was one report he had, you know, five stories of deaths, murders. These were of utmost fascination to him. And he pioneered the idea of visiting crime scenes and describing in visceral detail what he had found there. And so in a story that was still shocking when you read it today, he went to the scene of a prostitute who had been murdered with a hatchet. And he described this beautiful woman, more beautiful than Venus de Milo, he said, who was utterly perfect in her complexion, but for the gashes in her head from the axe and the fact that she'd been set on fire by the murderer. So he had this very intense, visceral sense. And, you know, this is a time, you don't have TV, you don't have radio. It is just the printed word in these newspaper stories. And so soon this rival paper, the New York Tribune, began to gain on the New York Sun. The third newspaper, I kind of forget the name right now, focused only on sports, sort of an ancestor to ESPN, horse racing and boxing. I don't know if they had boxing, horse racing and other sports. So the New York Sun realized that it was in some trouble, started to lose sales. They needed something to juice it up a little bit. So one day, this will be near the end of the story, there came a new exclusive, a series of dispatches from the scientist who had the world's largest telescope in South Africa. And he was there to report, factually, of course, with scientific detail, on what they had found on the moon. Well, and this had some pictures as well. Well, the first couple stories was nothing special. They had gigantic lakes on the moon, huge trees, grassy plains. It was in the third installment of the story, which already started to move circulation up, where they revealed the discovery of the unicorn on the moon. That's where they came from. And in the final two installments, they discovered the man bat. Creature not unlike ourselves, except that it had wings and a voracious sexual appetite, and was wandering around the moon, involved in various forms of behavior. As you can imagine, this story was a hit. I mean, it was published as news. It was not published as fiction. Never retracted. No one ever proved it was wrong either. I mean, how are you supposed to prove it's wrong? Who has the world's largest telescope? So that was, and that success took the New York Sun. Its circulation, you know, went up and up and up. Although, of course, we don't really know if they're telling the truth about circulation. But they claimed the circulation by the end of that year of over 17,000. Seems that didn't like that story. Of over 17,000, which pushed the paper past some of the English dailies, which had been invented earlier, and into the position. And I think you learn a couple things about this business model, the attention merchant business model, from these early episodes. When you think about normal business, it is a competition to have a better product or a lower price. The attention merchant, the attention gaining business model, is focused on trying to attract the largest crowd, and therefore the race is usually to the bottom, whether you can be more lurid, more outrageous, more attention-gaining. That is the name of the game. And we see that pattern repeated throughout the history of the attention merchants. Let me turn to a second point of history, which I think is important to the story. And I'm going to give you about four or five of these, and then we'll move to questions. So, I don't know if you've ever thought about this. I certainly did. The question of when was advertising invented? And when did advertising become popularized? Well, there's been advertisements for a long time, at least in the sense of information about products. In fact, some of the early scrawlings in Pompeii, in Italy, that were buried by the volcano, turn out to be advertising for erotic services. But real advertising, and by real advertising I mean content designed not just to inform, but to persuade, to influence, to manipulate, that is a development of the late 19th century and early 20th century. And I want to talk about two important points in this sequence. So a lot of what we now call advertising techniques were invented to sell what are now known as patent medicine. In my book, there is the story of a fellow named Clark Stanley. He liked to call himself the Rattlesnake King. His technique of advertising, he was a medicine man. He went from town to town, or sometimes he appeared at the Chicago World's Fair, and he was dressed as he was a cowboy. He had a hat and a bandana and a big goatee, sort of an exotic appearance, but he made it even more so by the fact that he would often have snakes wrapped around him, and his booth would be crawling with rattlesnakes. He was not afraid of the creatures. He said he'd been bitten hundreds of times, and they had no effect on him. He would do the following. Once the crowd had gathered to see these snakes, I mean, snakes are pretty, ever since the Garden of Eden, they've been something that attracts human attention. Once the crowd had gathered, he would kill a snake, he would boil it on the spot, take up the oil that was generated, and mix it into a potion, which he called Clark Stanley Snake Oil, a cure for all problems that afflict man or beast. And he was, and him and some of his friends in patent medicine advertisers, were the originators, the real pioneers of the advertising industry. Now, why was that? Well, the medicines didn't actually work, patent medicines. They might have worked a little bit. Actually, among them, snake oil might have been one of the better ones. But most of them were just potions that were of an unknown effect. Some of them put in some drugs and so forth, but they didn't do what they promised. So in order to succeed this industry, it had to sell you on the product. In order to succeed, Cloud Hopkins, an early advertising man, said, with medicine, advertising must do it all. And they developed many of the techniques, the hard sell techniques, which would come to be the advertising industry as it went forward. Maybe I'll describe some of those if we have a moment, and maybe you'll see some of the relevance to politics later on. The key of patent medicine advertising, and really of all advertising, was to understand first that you had to gain the attention of an audience by being outlandish, by being colorful, by something crazy like rattlesnakes, swamp root, promising a cure for death or heart disease. Next, and second, in the second step, there was always this effort to understand some of the deepest fears or desires of the public. Now, with medicine, it's pretty easy. Most people fear death. They don't want to die. Most people, no one likes illness, especially if you suffer chronically from illness. You'll try almost anything. But third, and the most important, was the total confidence with which they promised a solution. I am the deliverance, said the medicine, more or less. I will cure that which ails you. Reading the old copy for some of these advertisements is very eye-opening. Where they say things like, has every other doctor failed you? Is anything that was promised to you not succeed? I am the one who will cure you. You just need to give it a shot. Of course, they didn't work either, but it didn't matter if the people had already parted with their money. So advertising had its beginnings in these kind of special medicines, but it really became popular. So I'll say about it is that advertising, while it started to be used in the late 19th century, had not reached the mainstream. It was seen as disreputable. Many people really doubted if it worked. Businesses, mainstream businesses, did not advertise 100 years ago. That changed after the First World War, and I think we need to give credit to the country of Great Britain for the invention of systematic propaganda and its effect on the advertising industry. So Britain, moving back to 1914, and I promise eventually I'll get to this, to our century. Britain in 1914 had declared war on the German Empire. Britain at that point had an army of about maybe more than 100,000 soldiers, many of them were in India. The German Empire, in contrast, had 4 million soldiers that just occupied Belgium and was coming into France. So the British government, headed then by Lord Kitchener, or the War Secretary, Lord Kitchener, realized it needed to do something if they were going to raise an army. Tradition at the time suggested that conscription or the draft was out of the question. And so Kitchener and Parliament turned to a systematic advertising or propaganda campaign designed to recruit soldiers into the British Army. And this was the first truly scale advertising campaign of its nature. There were printed millions of pamphlets. Posters covered almost every available public surface. There were rallies in the streets over and over again. And what this effort proved, millions of people joined the army. Many of them did so even though 6 months into it, it was pretty clear that if you joined the army, you had about a 50-50 chance of being killed or permanently injured in some serious way, becoming a casualty. Nonetheless, people joined. And it was so successful, this propaganda effort, so successful, this recruitment, that it proved for once and for all that advertising worked, or at least in the minds of business. And in fact, we have very clear evidence from this, particularly among the Americans who participated in the American propaganda version of the American propaganda campaign. Edward Bernays, a famous, some of you may know him, a famous man in this history, inventor of what was called public relations, said that we learned that what was useful in war could even be more useful in times of peace. For the purpose of business, the use of these methods of propaganda was invaluable. He wrote a book, Propaganda, frankly, that was the name of the book, which was the use of the tools of propaganda for business. So that's another turning point. I want to move to one or two more. The advertising model just described, advertising and attention, reselling human attention and advertising, had been established by the 1920s or so. The next set of the story is its expansion into different media. We saw an expansion into radio, saw an expansion into television, and bit by bit, areas of life which people once considered off-limits or never imagined there'd be advertising eventually became part of this model. One example was radio, where at one point it was considered unthinkable that you would bring advertising into the home. The home was a sacred place, or so people said. It's impossible that they'll tolerate advertising for toothpaste inside their homes, but slowly but surely it happened this way. Television also, some people said, this is too great a miraculous an invention. We can't have advertising on television, but pretty soon that fell away as well. The computer, personal computers and mainframe computers, invented in the 70s and 80s, I think that if you suggested to someone in the 70s that email and computers would become a major advertising platform, they would have thought you were completely crazy. And some of you may be old enough to remember computers with the, just the terminal and the green letters, and the idea that it would be not just a tool of yours, but also to try to get you interested in commercial messages seemed unlikely. And finally, another kind of such barrier, the social sphere, our friends, our family, the idea that they would recommend products or be part of an advertising campaign, which is essentially the business model of Facebook and Twitter and similar social media, that also, I think, was a surprise, would have surprised an earlier generation. So the story in the book is clearly one of expansion. I'll maybe say one more thing about this book and its stories. There is a pattern which recurs throughout history of advertising increasing its scope, getting into new areas, but a reverse pattern, which is that of revolts against advertising. At various times in history, people, the public, have gotten fed up and have, one way or another, tried to limit advertisers, regulate them, do something about it, or tuned out altogether. One example is the turn of the century in Paris. It's against the poster. But I want to tell a different story, the first technological story of resistance to advertising, which occurs in the 1950s and is centered on the television commercial. So in the 1950s, there started to be commercials. And there was a company, Zenith. Does anyone remember this company, Zenith? They're still kind of around. They were the maverick company in the United States of the early 20th century, kind of like the Apple, think different kind of company. The president was a man named Commodore MacDonald. That's what he called himself. He had been in the Naval Reserve, and he insisted everyone call him the Commodore. He did have an enormous boat in Chicago that she had parties on. He was an eccentric, weird guy. You know, there's sort of a long history of very strange people taking over tech companies or running tech companies. One of the experiments I think was most interesting, so what's good about writing a book, you get to do a lot of strange research, is he tried very seriously to make ESP, or telepathy, work over the radio waves. He was convinced if you got the frequency right, that you could transmit thoughts over radio. And so they had a special hour that was devoted on their radio stations to telepathy, where he simply wanted people to write down the thoughts that were being sent out by the... I'm not sure if it worked. I couldn't figure that out. Anyway, he hated commercials. He thought they were ruining television, ruining radio. He wanted something to be done. So he went to his engineers and he said, I want you to come up with a technology that will kill the advertisement, kill the commercial. And so they did some research and came back. And they came back with something that was, they eventually shaped like a kind of pistol, a revolver. And you'd aim at the TV and shoot the advertisement, or shoot the commercial. That technology we now know is the remote control. And the origins of the remote control, whatever they're used for today, lie in this idea of resistance to advertising. I'll close my opening remarks with a discussion of our present situation. I think we're in the midst of something of an uncertain period when it comes to the balance between advertising and content. I think we're in some degree in the middle of a revolt. There are people who use ad blockers. There's a lot of cord cutters. Sometimes you'll meet people and they say they don't watch advertisements in the same way you might say you have a gluten-free diet or you're a vegetarian. I just don't watch ads. You know, it's not what I do. It's provoked a crisis. You know, I live in New York where the advertising industry is. They feel, I think, desperate. The fact that football ratings are down this year has provoked something of an existential crisis. And the problem is that has led to, I think, an acceleration or even more efforts to reach people. I think the web has been profoundly changed, and this is one of the reasons I wrote this book. The web has been profoundly changed by the rise of an advertising model. I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you go and you want to write like an email, and then you sit down at your computer and all of a sudden you notice 3 hours have gone by and you don't quite know what happened. Sort of like being in a casino where you just put one bet, Or if you're an alcoholic, you have one drink and all of a sudden the whole day disappears. There's been this effect on the web. You know, much of the content is more attention-getting, clickbaity. And I think that has quite a lot to do with the underlying business model. That is, the advertising-driven business model wants you constantly clicking, wants you sort of in distracted mode, wants you to not be deeply engrossed, let's say in a book or something, but constantly looking at new stuff, possibly absorbing messages in order to generate what are actually not even that much, but some amounts of advertising revenue. So I think we're at a moment here where it is time, and the reason I wrote this book really, there's also some political ramifications of this model, which I'll talk about, where I think we are, as in any time, starting to ask what kind of civilization we want to live in, what we want our culture to look like, the main mediums we have, television, the web. I think it's important to notice and understand just how much the business model will drive what kind of culture and society we have, and to be asked some hard questions about advertising models and what they do for us. So I will leave it there, and I'm very happy to take questions. Thank you. Where should we start? Do you want to do the questions? Oh, I can tell you that very clearly. So let me repeat the question. The question is, when would you think that psychology and the learnings of psychology became used to try to push people into thinking certain ways? I guess, when does psychology start to have an influence on advertising? Is that a fair way of rephrasing the question? So the answer to the question is the 1920s. In the 1920s, the advertising industry was obsessed and fascinated with the idea of scientific advertising. And they were particularly interested in the ideas of what was called the behavioralist school of advertising and the work of a man named Thomas Watson, who was a scientist who became an advertising executive at the J. Walter Thompson Company. And his essential idea, his thinking, was that man and humans and animals were basically the same. Their behavior was subject to predictable responses to stimuli, and you could therefore essentially program humans to do what you wanted. They're very crude about this idea. Performed, those days, scientific protocols were different, so they performed their experiments on human infants. And in one of the experiments I was looking at, famous the Little Albert experiments, purported to prove that humans were programmable. They had a baby, and they had a mouse. And they showed the mouse the baby. The baby liked the mouse. But then they showed the mouse to the baby and then began beating a metal bar behind the baby's head. And the baby began to cry. And then every time they showed the mouse to the baby, they would beat a metal bar behind the baby's head and began to cry. And eventually, all they had to do was show the mouse to the baby, and the baby would begin to cry. And even beyond that, the paper was proud to announce that they had made the baby afraid of all white and furry objects, even Santa Claus. So they had developed some kind of stimulated response. So this gentleman who wrote this paper, who, as I said, later became an advertising executive, was hired, essentially had the idea they could replicate that experience for the entire population. That's where it started. And it started with, some people thought the Freudian theories were baked into the ideas of advertising earlier on. But that came a lot later in the 1950s. If you want, I can talk about that, because it's pretty interesting too. But the original idea was just conditioned responses. We can program people. Maybe I'll give an example of an advertising campaign from the 20s that draws on this. The Listerine campaigns of the 20s interest me. So in the 20s, advertisers had the idea suddenly that women were the appropriate target for advertising. Before the 20s, it was just like advertisements were just for anyone. They were like, no. Women, there was a suffragette movement going on, so there was this idea that women make their own decisions. Sometimes they don't listen to their husbands. Maybe we need to target women. So I've got to say, the early targeting women, relatively crude. Listerine campaign took the following approach, targeted to women, a little bit borrowing from the psychological approach as well. They sat around. Listerine had been used for washing floors and as a battlefield disinfectant. So it was under new management, and they're like, well, what are we going to do with this stuff? They had the idea of a mouthwash. But no one had ever heard, no one used mouthwash. So they came up with a campaign, what they called the Little Edna campaign. Oh, Pathetic Edna. Poor Little Edna, let me get it right. So Edna, although she was charming and beautiful as any other girl, was often a bridesmaid, but never a bride. She was wonderful, everyone liked her, but nobody would tell her that she had bad breath. She was quickly approaching the tragic age of 30 without having found a husband. Solution to her problem, Listerine mouthwash. No one will tell you if you have bad breath, you have to take care of it yourself. So you can see a very relatively crude effort to identify the fears of women and try to offer a solution to them. And that was like the essential of this psychological approach. Tobacco manufacturers did similar, this is in the book as well, with basically the idea of selling cigarettes as a diet aid. Their idea, women are afraid of becoming fat or overweight, so we need to sell cigarettes as a way to stay thin. Reach for a Lucky instead of a Sweet. And there's ads, a picture of you, the women are, you know, is this you in 5 years and this beautiful sort of thin woman, and then an image of a giant, fat, grotesque woman, reach for a Lucky instead of a Sweet. So they weren't very subtle in the early days. They just definitely went for the very hardcore kind of psychological techniques. Thanks for that question. Another question, this gentleman here. That's a great question. I think this is a really interesting question. Do we, with a constant exposure to advertising, become more sophisticated? So I have like three things to say about that. So one theme in this book is to understand to some degree the human mind and how our attention works. And one amazing power we have is the power to ignore things, the power to tune out. Have you ever been talking to someone, you realize they are not hearing a word you're saying? You know, we have these powers. And most advertising campaigns at first are effective, and then people start to tune them out, and they almost like they disappear. So this has been a constant challenge for the advertising industry. And frankly, the entertainment industry as well. People just get disinfected. They lose interest. And I think that so almost every campaign, people, what seems so riveting, exciting at first, just kind of disappears. On the other hand, I think we sometimes flatter ourselves by thinking we're so much, you know, more sophisticated than earlier generations. When I've looked at more advertising than maybe almost anyone. And, you know, some of the techniques are so in the old days, especially with the miracle cures, there was like snake oil or swamp root or some strange, you know, Indian concoction of some kind. But, you know, today, how many miracle cures are there? You know, acai berries or raspberry ketones backed by, you know, dubious silence of one kind or another. You know, people, or in the tech world, you'll throw some, this has some stats that are supposed to impress you, or Nike Air shoes or whatever. You know, we're very susceptible still, I think. You know, shampoos with carrot extractors and 1,000 different ingredients. So I don't know if we really are that, like, much. I don't really know. I think, and I guess I'll say that we're sometimes in danger of overestimating ourselves and thinking we're so much more sophisticated. And you even look back 20, look at the ads from 20 years ago, and you're like, wow, they fell for that stuff? And I'm sure there's 20 years from now, they'll be like, wow, I can't believe they fell for that. So I don't know. I think they do keep changing, and you get used to them. But I think we fall for it. So another question. Maybe you in the front.
Can you talk about the awareness?
Yeah, that's a good question. The question is about the effect of essentially attentional markets or the necessity of gaining attention on politics and political markets. Right, how people are exposed to, so there's another aspect of the question, which is Just a little bit about filter bubbles and this kind of phenomenon, people being exposed only to certain things that they want to see. So the business, the fact that the business model of most of the media and most of the major information platforms in our time, Google and Facebook and Twitter, is premised on maximizing attention as their revenue model, I think has led in a number of directions that you will recognize. Politics was never like it was not like this completely, but I think increasingly in politics, the initial battle for attention has become so important. You know, people don't hear about candidates, especially local candidates, at all. Most local candidates, you know, people don't even know are running. It takes, having run for office myself, I can tell you, I ran for lieutenant governor in New York, probably Washington State, so I wasn't targeting this audience. Actually, we had some luck. We were somewhat unknown, but we managed to, we were challenging the governor kind of for fun and got 40% of the vote. So that was successful, although, you know, the early days, I realized just how hard it is. It's not like you say, I'm running for office and people pay attention. You need to have, a sort of a celebrity name will help, especially a political dynasty, Kennedy or Clinton, someone like Trump, who's already a celebrity, or you're a billionaire. These are the sort of automatic prerequisites of getting you in the attentional game. I think that politics has been, and almost, actually not only politics, but, well, we're talking about politics, so many areas, but politics have somewhat taken on the economics of the entertainment industry, where there's, you know, a huge attention, huge importance, and who can get attention at all. One thing about Donald Trump that I thought was so interesting in the early stages of the Republican primary is he seemed to understand better than the other candidates that it didn't matter how much he knew about the issues, it just mattered how much coverage he got. And, you know, he was losing, supposedly, the debates, but he was destroying his opponents in terms of coverage. You know, I think they estimated over the early days he got something like $2 billion in free media coverage because he was the most interesting, because he said crazy things, because he was a celebrity already, and because he'd mastered the arts of gaining attention by being outlandish and outrageous, and that worked to him. So he won that battle first. I can talk more about the Trump candidacy if you want. Because my book, if you read this book, you'll see it's kind of like, oh, so this is why Trump is president. I think if you'll see, oh yes, this is he, this technique. The techniques are all there. It's almost like a manual. He kind of knew it all because he's in this business of show business already, and he knew that being restricted by things like not wanting to say some things, caring about facts, consistency, or consistency with Republican views, or just internal consistency, those things really weren't as important as gaining a big audience and then speaking to their deepest fears and desires and presenting the answers. That sort of three-step thing I said, which is at the bottom of most successful sales, is that irresistible power of essentially absorbing what your audience really wants to hear and promising you will deliver it. He did that very effectively, I'll suggest. You said, I've gone a little bit on too long, but I think you get some sense of how political markets have been affected. Filter bubbles and why they arrive, why people just see the news that matters to them. Well, if you have a business model of companies like Facebook or others, they care only about maximization of your time and attention with it, your engagement. That's the only metric. Truth, you know, this is why fake news has become so controversial. They care only about engagement. That's the business model. So what is going to engage a liberal person? Well, liberal content. What engages a far-right white supremacist? White supremacist content. So you end up getting stuff catered to you because that's more engaging. It's the ultimate stage of targeting. Now, whether or not that's a good thing as a commercial matter, whether it's helpful, you know, or to get product in advertising jargon, to get products you care about that are relevant to you, is one thing. As a political matter, it is completely disastrous. as I think, in my opinion, we've seen. So we have a model which is designed for commercial purposes to give you what you want. You know, so I'm me, I like wearing these shoes, so I get content about shoes, I like motorcycles, I get content about motorcycles. But then it goes in the political realm and maps all of your political preferences as well, and that's how you end up with this situation we have. Oh, just one more question. I'm sorry I've gone on these two answers. I'm gonna look like you want something you want to ask. Right. Well, the United States, by its very design, is very conscious and critical of government behavior, maybe because of the revolution or who knows what, but much less concerned with private conduct. And I think that anchors some of that big difference you'll see. I just want to add to that, since this is the last question, I'll throw a few ideas in that are not exactly related. I think we are starting to learn, maybe we already know, that we pay for things in different ways. You can pay for something with money. We all know that. But many of the things that seem free in our life, you're actually paying either with your private information or with your time and attention. And, you know, by watching ads, allowing yourself the potential to be influenced. And one of the things I hope I leave you with this idea is that, you know, there is no such thing as free. Maybe libraries are free. Maybe that's the exception. But when it comes to commercially oriented products, you will be paying one way or another, whether it's by giving over your information, whether it's opening yourself up to influence. And I think it's really time for us to think hard about the almost obsession or addiction we have, not addiction's too strong, but the assumption we have that so many things in our life should be free, and to pay for them by giving our time and our attention isn't to pay at all. We are paying. You can see it in some of our mental states. I think we may look back at this period 20 years from now and be like, wow, you know, we really let things get a little out of control. I think it's become very hard to control your own time and attention when we live in an environment which is very much like an attentional casino, where every single little step will lead you down long rabbit holes, not always advertising-based, but based on a very powerful environment we live on that is interested in taking us away often from other people or things like reading a book or something that are where there's no advertising involved, to long flights of fancy that may not always be suiting our purposes. So my book is a call, ultimately, to take repossession of our time and attention, to think hard about how you spend your mental cycles, and realize that it is really the scarcest resource and a large part of what it means to be human. Thank you very much. If anyone wants to have a book, I'll be sitting over here.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.